We begin with the story of 98.6. You know the number, right? It is one of the most famous numbers there is because the body temperature of a healthy human being is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, isn't it? The story of 98.6
dates back to a physician by the name of Carl Wunderlich.
This was in the mid-1800s. Wunderlich was medical director of the hospital at Leipzig University. In that capacity, he
oversaw the care and the taking of vital signs on some 25,000 patients.
Pretty big data set, yes? 25,000 patients. And what did Wunderlich determine?
He determined that the average temperature of the normal human being was 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 37 degrees centigrade.
This is Philip Makowiak, a professor of medicine and a medical historian at the University of Maryland.
Well, I am an internist by trade and an infectious disease specialist by subspecialty. So my bread and butter is fever.
There's one more thing Makowiak is.
I am by nature a skeptic, and it occurred to me very early in my career that this idea that 98.6 was normal and that if you didn't have a temperature of 98.6, you were somehow abnormal, just didn't sit right.
Philip Makowiak, you have to understand, cares a lot about what is called clinical thermometry. And if you care a lot about clinical thermometry, you care a lot about the thermometer that Carl Wunderlich used to establish 98.6.
His thermometer is an amazing key to this story of 98.6.
So you can imagine how excited Makowiak was when, on a tour of the weird and wonderful Mütter Museum in Philadelphia, the curator told him they had one of Wunderlich's original thermometers.
I said, "Good heavens, may I see it?" And she said, "Sure, would you like to borrow it?" And I said, "Of course." And so I was able to take this thermometer back to Baltimore and do a number of experiments.
The Wunderlich thermometer, Makowiak realized, was not at all a typical thermometer.
First of all, it was about a foot long, fairly thick stem, and registered almost 2 degrees centigrade higher than current thermometers or thermometers of that era.
2 degrees higher? Centigrade? Uh-oh. Makowiak noticed something else about the original Wunderlich research.
Investigating further, it became apparent that he was not measuring temperatures either in the mouth or the rectum. He was measuring axillary or armpit temperatures, and so that in many, many ways, his results are not applicable to temperatures that are taken using current thermometers and current techniques.
As it turns out, the esteemed Dr. Carl Wunderlich
was not the most careful investigator ever to come on the scene.
The more Makowiak looked into the Wunderlich data and how the story of 98.6 came to be, the more he wondered about its accuracy. So he set up his own body temperature study. He recruited healthy volunteers, male and female, and took their temperature 1 to 4 times a day, around the clock, for about 2 days, using a well-calibrated digital thermometer in the patient's mouths. What did he find?
Of the total number of temperatures that were taken, only 8% were actually 98.6. And so if you believe that 98.6 is the normal temperature, then 92% of the time the temperature was abnormal. Obviously, that's not even reasonable.
In his study, Makowiak found the actual normal temperature to be 98.2 degrees, not a huge difference. And yet, the whole notion of a normal body temperature was looking more and more suspect. Why? A lot of reasons. Temperature varies from person to person, sometimes so much that one person's normal would register as nearly feverish for another person.
It's almost like a fingerprint.
Temperature varies throughout the day. It's roughly 1 degree higher at night than in the morning, sometimes even more. And an elevated temperature isn't necessarily a sign of illness.
In women, it goes up with ovulation during the menstrual cycle. The temperature goes up during vigorous exercise, and this is not a fever.
And so, Makoviak concluded,
looking at a rise in temperature as a reliable sign of infection or disease is inappropriately simplistic thinking.
Inappropriately simplistic thinking. It makes you wonder, if the medical establishment believed for so long in an inappropriately simplistic story about something as basic as normal body temperature, what else have they fallen for? What other mistakes have they made? Hope you've got some time. It's a long list.
You take a sick person, slice open a vein, take a few pints of blood out of them.
Drilling holes into people's skulls.
It was literally taking someone to hell and back.
And it would cause a whole series of malformations and probably a lot of fetal death.
Lobotomies. The overuse of a mercury compound.
The Tuskegee case.
Losing your teeth and having your gums bleed.
DES and thalidomide.
We use sort of a cement.
Hormone replacement therapy.
The OxyContin and opioid problem.
As a medical historian, it is patently obvious to me that future generations will look at what we're doing today and ask themselves, what was Grandpa thinking of when he did that and believed that? And they'll have to learn all over again that science is imperfect. And to maintain a healthy skepticism about everything we believe and do in life in general, but in the medical profession in particular.
On today's show, we'll be talking about the new era of personalized medicine, the growing reliance on evidence-based medicine, and especially, pay attention now, I'm going to use a technical term, we will be talking about bad medicine.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We've got a lot of ground to cover in our Bad Medicine series. Medicine's greatest hits, the biggest failures, where we are now, and where we're headed. We're not even going to touch adjacent fields like nutrition and psychiatry. Maybe another time. Let's start, very briefly, at the beginning. Nearly 2,500 years ago, you had the Greek physician Hippocrates, who is still called the father of modern medicine. You've heard, of course, of the Hippocratic Oath, the creed recited by new doctors. And you know the oath's famous phrase, first do no harm, even though, as it turns out, that phrase isn't actually included in the oath. It came from something else Hippocrates wrote. Nor do many contemporary doctors recite the original Hippocratic Oath. There's a modern version, written in 1964 by the prominent pharmacologist Louis Lasagna. How well has that pledge been upheld throughout medical history? We'll talk to a variety of people about that today, starting with this gentleman.
My name is Anupam Jena. I'm a healthcare economist and physician at Harvard Medical School.
So Jena, as both a practitioner and an analytical researcher, is especially useful for our purposes because one of the themes we'll hit today several times is that medicine, even though it's scientific, or at least scientific-ish, hasn't always been as empirical as you might think, and sometimes not very empirical at all. Here's an easy question. Can you tell me, please, the history of medicine, or at least Western medicine, in, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes?
Well, let me first answer the meaning of life.
Is that going to be easier?
That'll take about 5 to 6 minutes. You know, I would say, how about 3 words, trial and error? So I think if you think about medicine, how it's evolved, let's just say, in the last 100 to 200 years, the sorts of practices that at some point in history people thought were actually medically legitimate included drilling holes into people's skulls, lobotomies, even as late as the 1940s to 1950s, lobotomies were thought to actually have a treatment effect in patients with mental illness, be it schizophrenia or depression. the practice of bloodletting, which is basically trying to remove the quote-unquote bad humors from the body, was thought to be therapeutic in patients. Things like mercury, which we know are downright toxic, were used as treatments in the past. And, you know, that was in a time and place where I think it was very difficult to get evidence. But not only that, there was probably a perception of the field that didn't allow for the ability to question itself. And in the last 50-plus years, probably 50 to 75 years, I think we've seen tremendous strides in the ability of the profession to constantly question itself.
So it's easy to get indignant over the idea of these treatments that turn out to be so wrong, but understanding wellness and illness is hard, obviously. So when you look back at the history of medicine, did those interventions strike you as kind of shameful? You can't believe you're in a profession that tried things like that? Or is that just part of the trial and error process that you accept?
I certainly wouldn't call it shameful. The only thing that's shameful is when someone doesn't believe that they have the potential for being wrong and they don't have that desire to inquire further about whether something actually works or doesn't work. But the idea of trying things, particularly trying things that have a really strong, plausible pathophysiologic basis, I think that there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's what spurs scientific discovery and many of the treatments that we have now.
So I have a broad question for you. The human body is, I think you and I would agree, an extraordinarily complex organism. And over history, doctors and others have learned a great deal about it. But if we consider the entire human body from a medical perspective only, let's leave out metaphysics and theology and what have you, from a medical perspective, how would you assess the share of the body and its functions that we truly understand and the share that we don't really yet understand?
Huh, that's a tough one. We've made a lot of headway. But to put a number on it, I would say maybe 30%, 40% that we don't know.
Ooh, that's a tough question for me to quantify.
I asked the same question of someone else.
My name is Jeremy Green. I'm a physician and a historian of medicine at Johns Hopkins.
So what's Green's answer?
There's a Rumsfeldian answer of, you know, known knowns.
There are known knowns.
Known unknowns.
Known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. There are also
unknown unknowns. A different way of answering that question would have to do with what our idea of the relevant science of medicine is.
For example?
If you take, for example, the moment in the Renaissance, when, you know, the Vesalian moment when the opening of cadavers and description and rendering in precise three-dimensional chiaroscuro engravings of the human body was an exciting area for research, that actually this humanist process of opening up cadavers, showing that the innards were not exactly what the ancient Greeks had described. So as a historian, rather than giving you a fixed percent of where we are, I can give you a Zeno's paradox, that we keep on getting close to that finite moment and then reinvent a new, broader room for us to inhabit.
And that's because there's been a lot of progress in how we're able to explore the human body.
There's the gross anatomy of the body, which you can see with your own eyes.
Anupam Jena again.
Then go a layer further, and we're now at the microscopic anatomy of the body. So now, what do the cells of the body look like when they are diseased under a microscope?
And now?
Now go a layer further, where you are now trying to understand things about the body that you can't even see with a microscope. And that's at, let's say, the level of the proteins in the cell, or even further down, the level of the DNA that encodes the protein.
By the end of the 20th century, there's a very strong genetic imaginary, which really helps to then fuel the excitement behind the Human Genome Project. It's thought once we know the totality of the human genome, we'll know all that we need to know about bodies and health and disease.
Of course, we already know a great deal. And to be fair, for all the mistakes and oversights in medicine, there's been extraordinary progress. What are some of medicine's greatest hits?
I would put something like the discovery of insulin right up there near the top.
That's Keith Whalew. He's a Princeton historian who focuses on health policy.
It transformed diabetes from an acute disease into a disease that you live with. And to me, that is much more the story of what medicine has been able to do in the 20th century.
The medicine that comes to my mind is statins. They've been shown to have benefit in preventing heart attacks, in the prolongation of life among people who've had heart attacks, and the same thing for stroke and other forms of cardiovascular disease. But there are many, many drugs that are like that.
These are truly awesome interventions for which we should all be thankful. One of the most remarkable developments over the past century and a half is the unbelievable gain in life expectancy. In the U.S. and elsewhere, it nearly doubled. Now, it might be natural to ascribe that gain primarily to breakthrough medicines, but in fact, a lot of it had to do with something else.
A lot of the advances in mortality and morbidity have come from really changes in the nature of social life. Infectious disease, as the source of high mortality in the early 20th century, began to drop long before penicillin and the antibacterials came along in the mid-century because of improvements in housing, sanitation, diet, and sort of tackling urban problems that really created congestion and produced the circumstances that made things like tuberculosis the leading cause of mortality.
For example, if you think about the reversal of the Chicago River, it used to flow into Lake Michigan in the 19th century, and people were dumping their waste into it. So every summer, there would be hundreds of deaths of babies and children from infant diarrhea because the water was so contaminated. They reversed the flow of the river, so it flowed down river toward the Mississippi, and that significantly improved the health of the people who lived there.
So we've got public health improvements to thank, and yes, better therapeutics and medicines. Also, new and better ways of finding evidence.
I actually think it's the technology that really revolutionized how we think is the use of controlled experiments.
That's Vinay Prasad. He is an assistant professor of medicine at Oregon Health and Sciences University. Prasad treats cancer patients, but also
the rest of my time I devote to research on health policy, on the decisions doctors make, on how doctors adopt new technologies, and when those things are rational and when they're not rational.
Which means that Prasad is part of a relatively new, relatively small movement to make medical science a lot more scientific.
You know, if you think about medical science, for thousands of years, what was medicine but something that somebody of esteemed authority had done for many years and told others that it worked for me, so you better do it.
Even though medical science seemed to be based on evidence, Prasad says
the reality was that what we were practicing was something called eminence-based medicine. It was where the preponderance of medical practice was driven by really charismatic and thoughtful, probably to some degree, leaders in medicine. And, you know, medical practice was based on bits and scraps of evidence, anecdotes, bias, preconceived notions, and probably a lot of psychological traps that we fall into. And largely from the time of Hippocrates and the Romans until, you know, maybe even the late Renaissance, medicine was unchanged. It was the same for a thousand years. Then something remarkable happened, which was the first use of controlled clinical trials in medicine.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how clinical trials began to change the game.
It really doesn't matter that the smartest people believe something works. The only thing that really counts is what is the evidence you have that it works.
How some people didn't have much of an appetite for actual evidence.
There was a great deal of hostility to it from, I'd say, the medical establishment.
And, in a strange twist, how better science is pushing medicine not always forward, but sometimes backwards.
It is quite common to see practices that end up getting reversed. And the best estimates are that happens about 15% of the time.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
In most developed countries, we tend to think of medicine as a rigorous science, and we think of our doctors as, if not infallible, at least reliable. But as we've been hearing, the history of medical science was often eminence-based rather than evidence-based. When did evidence really start to take over?
Evidence-based medicine has become hugely important in the last 25 to 30 years.
Anupam Jena is an MD and a healthcare economist. The movement is a result, Jena says, of at least two factors. Number one,
we're doing more randomized controlled trials, and that tells us more information about what works and doesn't work.
And number two,
improvements in computer technology have now allowed us to study data in a way that we couldn't have done 30 years ago.
There's also been a movement to collect and synthesize all that research and all those data.
So our vision is to produce systematic reviews that summarize the best available research evidence to inform decisions about health.
That's Lisa Barrow, a pharmacologist by training who studies the integrity of clinical and research evidence.
And I'm also co-chair of the Cochrane Collaboration.
The Cochrane Collaboration was founded in Britain, but is now a global network. The systematic reviews they produce
are really the evidence base for evidence-based medicine. And we've been a leader in so many ways in developing systematic reviews. We were the first to regularly update these reviews. We were one of the first to have post-publication peer review and a very strong conflict of interest policy. And actually, we were one of the first journals that was published only online.
Which means that whatever realm of medical science you're working on, you can access nearly all the evidence on all the research ever conducted in that realm, constantly updated, available on the spot. Compare that to how things used to work, looking up some 5 or 10-year-old medical journal to find one relevant article that may well have been funded by the pharmaceutical company whose drug it happened to celebrate. How is Cochrane funded?
We're primarily funded by governments and nonprofits.
What about industry money?
We don't take any money from industry to support any official Cochrane groups.
Which means, in theory at least, that the evidence assembled by the Cochrane Collaboration is pretty reliable evidence, as opposed to
a whole variety of things. Opinion, what the doctor had been taught 30 years previously in medical school. Tradition, what they had been told to do by or advised to do by a drug company representative that had visited them a week previously.
That is Sir Ian Chalmers, who co-founded the Cochrane Collaboration. He's a former clinician who specialized in pregnancy, childbirth, and early infancy. He was a medical student in the early 1960s. When Chalmers observed his elders in practice, he was struck by how much variance there was from doctor to doctor.
Okay, so some doctors would, if a woman had a baby presenting by the breech, would do a cesarean section without any questions asked, as it were. Or they may take different views about the way that the baby should be monitored during labor, or the extent to which drugs should be used during pregnancy for one thing or another. So lots and lots of differences in practices. It's as long as your arm. It's madness, isn't it?
When he became a doctor himself, Chalmers worked at a refugee camp in Gaza. And as he discovered,
some of the things that I had learned at medical school were lethally wrong.
Like how you were supposed to treat a child with measles.
I'd been taught at medical school never to give antibiotics to a child with a viral infection, which measles is, because you might induce resistance to the antibiotic resistance. But these children died really quite fast after getting pneumonia from bacterial infection, which comes on top of the viral infection of the measles. And what was most frustrating was that it wasn't until some years later that I found that there had been 6 controlled trials comparing antibiotic prophylaxis given preventatively with nothing done by the time I arrived in Gaza.
And those studies suggested that children with measles should be given antibiotics. But Chalmers had never seen those studies.
So I feel very sad that in retrospect, I let my patients down.
This led Chalmers to embark on a years-long effort to systematically create a centralized body of research to help attack the incomplete, random, subjective way that too much medicine had been practiced for too long. He was joined by a number of people from around the world, many of whom, by the way, were more versed in statistics than in medicine. And so the Cochrane Collaboration became the first organization to really systematize, compile, and evaluate the best evidence for given medical questions. You'd think this would have been met with universal praise. But as with any guild whose inveterate wisdom is challenged, as unwise as that wisdom may be, the medical community wasn't thrilled.
There was a great deal of hostility to it from, I'd say, the medical establishment. In fact, I remember a colleague of mine was going off to speak to a local meeting of the British Medical Association, who had basically summoned him to give an account of evidence-based medicine and what the hell did people who were statisticians and other non-doctors think they were doing, messing around in territory which they shouldn't be messing around in. And he asked me before he drove off, what should I tell them? I said, when patients start complaining about the objectives of evidence-based medicine, then one should take the criticism seriously. Up until then, assume that it's basically vested interests playing their way out.
It took a long while, but the Cochrane model of evidence-based medicine did become the new standard.
I would say it wasn't actually until this century. So one way you can look at it is where there is death, there is hope. As a cohort of doctors who rubbished it moved into retirement and then death, the opposition disappeared.
Yeah, so that's been the slower evolution.
That, again, is Vinay Prasad from Oregon Health and Science University.
The very first studies with randomization concerned tuberculosis.
This was in the late 1940s.
And then from then until really the 1980s, the end of the 1980s, we did use randomized trials, but they weren't mandatory. They were sort of optional.
One big benefit of a randomized trial is that you can plainly measure in the data the cause and effect of whatever treatment you're looking at. This may sound obvious, but it is remarkable how many medical treatments of the past were conducted without that evidence. Anupam Jena again.
I think some of the biggest mistakes in the last century, let's say the first from 1900 to 1950, things like lobotomies to treat mental illness, either depression or schizophrenia, those strike me as being some of the most horrific things that could be done to man without any really solid evidence base at all.
This is one of the trickiest things about practicing medicine day to day. Let's say you're a doctor and a patient comes to see you with a persistent headache. You make a diagnosis and you write a prescription. What happens next? In many cases, you have no idea. The feedback loop in medicine is often very, very sloppy. Did the patient get better? Maybe. They never came back. But maybe they went to a different doctor. Or maybe they died. If they did get better, was it because of the medicine you prescribed? Maybe. Or maybe they didn't even fill the script. Or maybe they did fill the script, but stopped taking it because they got an upset stomach. Or maybe they did take the medicine and they did get better, but maybe they would have gotten better without the medicine. Like I said, you have no idea. But with a well-constructed, randomized controlled trial, you can get an idea. Vinay Prasad again.
The moment, I think, in my mind that kind of set us on a different course was a study called CAST.
CAST stands for Cardiac Arrhythmia Suppression Trial. It was conducted in the late 1980s.
CAST was a study that one of the things doctors were doing a lot for people after they had a heart attack was prescribing them an antiarrhythmic drug that was supposed to keep those aberrant rhythms, those bad heart rhythms, at bay. That drug actually, in a carefully done randomized trial, turned out not to improve survival as we all had thought, but to worsen survival. And that was a watershed moment, I think, where people realized that randomized trials can contradict even the best of what you believe. It really doesn't matter in medicine that the smartest people believe something works. The only thing that really counts is what is the evidence you have that it works.
The rise of randomized controlled trials led to a rise in what are called medical reversals. Vinay Prasad wrote the book on medical reversals, literally. It's called Ending Medical Reversal.
And, you know, what is a medical reversal? Doctors do something for decades. It's widely believed to be beneficial. And then one day, a very seminal study, often better designed, better powered, better controlled than the entirety of the pre-existing body of evidence, it contradicts that practice. It isn't just that it had side effects we didn't think about. It was that the benefits that we had postulated turned out to be not true or not present.
For instance,
in the 1990s, we would recommend to postmenopausal women to start taking estrogen supplements because we knew that women before they had menopause had lower rates of heart disease, and we thought that was because of a favorable effect of estrogen. And then in 2002, a carefully done randomized controlled trial found that actually it doesn't decrease heart attacks and strokes. In fact, if anything, it increases them.
As Prasad makes clear, there is a long, long list of medical treatments that simply don't stand up to empirical scrutiny.
One of the things we did in the course of our research was we took a decade worth of articles in probably one of the most prestigious medical journals, the New England Journal of Medicine, and there's about maybe 1,300 articles that concern something doctors do. About 1,000 of those articles were something new, something that came off, that, you know, is coming down the pipeline, the newest anticoagulant, the newest mechanical heart valve. And if you tested something new exactly as you'd expect, 77% of those published manuscripts concluded that what's newer is better. But we also discovered about 360 articles tested something doctors were already doing. But if you tested something doctors were already doing, 40% of the time we found that it was contradicted or a reversal.
I'd love you to talk about the various consequences of reversals, including perhaps a loss of faith in the medical system generally.
So if you find out something you were doing for decades is wrong, you harmed a lot of people. You subjected many people to something ineffective, potentially harmful, certainly costly, and it didn't work. The second harm, we say, is this lag time harm. Doctors, you know, we're like a battleship. We don't turn on a dime. We continue to do it for a few years after the reversal. And the third harm is loss of trust in the medical system. And that's the deepest harm. And I think we've seen it in the last decade, particularly with our shifting recommendations for mammography and for prostate cancer screening, where people come to the doctor and they say, you guys can't get your story straight. What's going on? It's a tremendous problem. And I'm afraid that probably what we are doing is we are making people feel like there is nothing that the doctor does that's really trustworthy. And I'm afraid that that's sort of the deepest problem that, you know, we face, this loss of trust.
Okay, so how do you not throw out the baby with the bathwater? What are some solutions to a practice of medicine and medical research that results in fewer reversals?
So that is a $1 million question. One is medical education. You know, we have a medical education where for 2 years, students are trained in the basic science of the body. Only in the latter years, the third and fourth year of medical school, are students trained in the epidemiology of medical science and evidence-based medicine and thinking not just how does something work, but what's the data that it does work. And, you know, I've argued that that needs to be flipped on its head, that the root, the basic science of medical school is evidence-based medicine. It's approaching a clinical question, knowing what data to seek and how to answer that in a very honest way. So that's one. The next category is regulation. And this is where you get into, you know, what is the FDA's role and what does the FDA do? And I think many people in the community hope that the products that are approved by the FDA are both safe and efficacious for what they do. But, you know, we were faced with a problem in the 80s and 90s that we had never faced before, which was the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And advocates rightly said that we need a way to get drugs to patients faster, maybe even accepting a little bit more uncertainty. And I think that was right. And I think that's still right for many conditions that are very dire, for which few other treatment options exist, and which sometimes have very low incidence. So it's very hard to do those studies because very few people have it. But what's happened is that mechanism has been extrapolated to conditions that are not dire, that have very good survival, that don't have few options, that actually have many options, and that many people do have. So we've had, again, sort of a slippery slope for, you know, what qualifies for this accelerated approval. So I think there's ways in which regulation can be adjusted. And then I think the last thing is the ethic of practicing physicians. You know, we have to have an ethic where when we offer something to someone and there's uncertainty, we should be very clear about communicating uncertainty. I think it's a tragedy today that, you know, no matter what you think of stenting for stable coronary artery disease, it's a tragedy that so many people who are having it done believe something that is clearly not true, that it lowers the rate of heart attacks and death. That's just factually not true. And the fact that many people believe that, I think, speaks to the fact that as doctors, we allow them to believe it.
And let me ask you one last question. I have a pretty good sense of having spoken to you now for a bit of what has prevented in the past medicine from being more scientific or more evidence-based. But what do you believe are the major barriers still that are still preventing it from becoming as evidence-based as you'd want it to be?
So we should be honest about what medicine is. And in the United States, medicine is something that now takes nearly or over 20% of GDP. It's a colossus in our economy. We spend more on medicine than any other Western nation. We probably don't get as much from it, from what we're spending, because it's such a large sector of the economy. The entrenched interests, the people who, the companies and the people who really profit from the current system are tremendously reluctant to change things. I think we see that with, just for one instance, the pharmaceutical drug pricing problem we're having right now. I think no one will doubt that the pharmaceutical industry has made some great drugs. They've also made some less than great drugs. But does every drug, great or worthless, have to cost $100,000 per year? And I don't invent that number. That's actually the cost per annum of the average cancer drug being approved in the United States in the last year, well over $100,000 per year of treatment. I think there's got to be a breaking point, and people are recognizing that.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how do those great drugs, and the less than great ones too, get made? And then how do they get to market? We'll look into the economics of new drug trials and how carefully the research subjects are chosen.
Now, that's very useful for a company that are trying to make their treatment look like it's effective. But does the population of people in this randomized trial really reflect the real-world people out there?
Well, look at who's been left out of most clinical trials.
That suggested that women shouldn't be included in clinical trials because of the potential adverse events to the fetus.
And how sometimes the only thing worse than being excluded from a medical trial was being included.
The use of vulnerable populations of African Americans, people in prison, children in orphanages, vulnerable populations like these have been used for medical experimentation for a fairly long time.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
In the mid-20th century, an exciting new drug hit the market. It was a sedative, but not a barbiturate, so it wasn't addictive, didn't clash with alcohol or other drugs, and, according to its manufacturer, was entirely safe. They based this claim on the fact that no matter how much of it they fed the rats did not die. Once this new sleeping pill was made available, doctors discovered it did more than help people sleep.
It would combat, for pregnant women, morning sickness.
And so, pregnant women all over the world were given the drug. It was called thalidomide.
The problem was the thalidomide would actually cross the placenta and impact the baby, and it would cause a whole series of malformations and probably a lot of fetal death.
Fetal deaths were thought to number at least 10,000. Among the babies who survived, there were serious birth defects.
Children that survived were deaf and blind, had a number of disabilities. They had shortened or lacked limbs.
Babies born with horribly malformed limbs, with missing or malfunctioning organs, because of the putatively super safe drug their mothers took to prevent morning sickness. Thalidomide was on the market for roughly 5 years before it was banned. Its German manufacturer, Chemie Grünenthal, first denied the disastrous side effects before ultimately accepting blame. The history of medicine is full of tragic missteps, but thalidomide, coming as it did during a boom in global mass media, made more noise than most.
The problem of tighter controls to prevent the distribution of dangerous drugs such as thalidomide is a matter of concern to the president at his news conference.
Concern over the tragic effects of the new sedative thalidomide prompts President Kennedy.
Already, more than 7,000 children have been born with some or all of their arms and legs missing.
Every doctor, every hospital, every nurse has been notified.
Although a few million thalidomide tablets had been distributed to doctors in the United States for trial use, it was never approved for sale here. That was thanks to a doctor at the Food and Drug Administration named Frances Oldham Kelsey. She did not believe that the application from the American distributor offered complete and compelling evidence of the drug's safety. President Kennedy later hailed Dr. Kelsey as a hero.
The alert work of our Food and Drug Administration, and particularly Dr. Frances Kelsey, prevented this particular drug from being distributed commercially in this country.
Even though the U.S. was an outlier in blocking thalidomide, the disaster had a number of lasting effects on American drug regulation. For one, the FDA established much more stringent rules for drug approval. It also rewrote the rules on what kind of people should be included in clinical trials.
Because of the effects on young women and on the fetus, it suggested that women shouldn't be included in clinical trials because of the potential adverse events to the fetus.
Meaning women were summarily excluded from early clinical trials for new drugs. On one level, this might make sense. It's a protective impulse. But this impulse had a downside.
The study of women in general became part of the collateral damage of that pregnancy conversation. So there certainly are young women who are not pregnant who could be included in clinical trials, and women in general could be included in clinical trials to really understand some of the effects of drugs on their own health. And they were labeled as broadly vulnerable because of the potential to become pregnant. And I think that was part of a very rapid response to a very, very visible tragedy.
We see this all the time. Something terrible happens, and we rush to introduce laws or regulations or just mores that respond to the terrible thing, but often wind up overcorrecting. Think about the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor accident in 1979. No one was killed, and the lasting health and environmental effects were negligible. But it was so frightening that it essentially killed off the nuclear power expansion in the U.S. Even as other countries embraced nuclear as a relatively clean and safe way to make electricity, often using American technology, by the way, the U.S. retreated. What'd we do instead? We burned more and more coal to make electricity. Now, from an environmental and health perspective, coal is almost indisputably worse than nuclear, but that's where the correction took us. That's where the fear took us. And the fear of another thalidomide took us to exclude most women from early stage drug trials and also to underrepresent women for a time in phase 2 and 3 trials, even if the drug's market included women.
Diethylstilbestrol, or DES, was manufactured, in the early part of the 1900s.
That's Teresa Woodruff, who's been telling us the thalidomide story.
I'm the Watkins Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Northwestern University.
Woodruff also founded and directs the Women's Health Research Institute at Northwestern. For Teresa Woodruff, as for many in the medical community, the future holds great promise. But so many decisions are informed by mistakes of the past, like thalidomide and DES, which first became available in the 1930s.
So DES, it's an estrogenic compound, was being prescribed to pregnant women to prevent miscarriage. Miscarriage was thought at the time medically to be caused at some level by low estrogen. And so supplying this estrogenic-like factor was thought to correct a really difficult problem.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Was miscarriage, in fact, caused by an estrogen shortage?
It's probably not. It's multifactorial. There may be some cases where low estrogen would have a modest effect, but in general, that's not the case.
DES, as it turned out, wasn't very effective in preventing miscarriage. Worse yet, it sometimes produced side effects that would become manifest only years later in the offspring of the women who'd taken DES. It affected boys and especially girls.
Well, the physicians just started reviewing the medical records of these young women who were now coming up with this very, very rare vaginal cancer. The onset of that disease is clearly estrogen dependent, probably a very narrow window during pregnancy when estrogen would have that effect. DES and thalidomide are both tragedies, but it wasn't that the physicians were going out to try and create an adverse problem for women who were pregnant. But as you look back across medicine, across science, we're always learning.
In 1977, because of the tragic consequences of DES and thalidomide, the FDA made a big change. It recommended excluding from early clinical trials all premenopausal females capable of becoming pregnant, unless they had life-threatening diseases, which meant that many of the drugs that later came to market had been tested only on male subjects, which could cause some real trouble for women.
A great example of this is the drug Ambien, which was just the latest of the large number of drugs that had adverse events in females.
Ambien is a sleeping pill whose main ingredient is a drug called Zolpidem. Americans love their sleeping pills. About 60 million prescriptions are written each year for roughly 9 million people. Some two-thirds of these medications contain Zolpidem, which was approved by the FDA in 2007. But as it turned out, men and women metabolize the drug differently.
The drug maker actually have in the FDA filing the metabolism of this drug in males and females, and in fact knew that it cleared the circulation of males faster than it did females. But they only studied the efficacy on males, had no females in that efficacy study.
When you say the clearance, it means how quickly the body is metabolizing, yes, essentially?
That's right. How long that drug is available in the body. So it's going to depend on individuals. And so some drugs will go into the fat and will be available for longer. So how much fat exists and what kind of fat can take up some of the drugs. But probably the most important part of drug metabolism is the liver. And so males and females have different enzymes and different P450s that are on the liver. And so that can alter the way drugs get cleared. For example, you know, women wake faster from sedation with anesthetics, so they recover much more slowly and have more reported pain events in hospital.
Talk for a few moments about the differences between females and males in medicine and or medical science.
Well, so I think one is hormones, and that's what we often think about. Males have testosterone and females have estrogen and progesterone. And so those hormones influence a lot of the biology of males and females in a very distinct and different way. But the fundamental way males and females differ is that every cell in a male's body is XY and every female cell is XX. And the sex chromosomes actually also inform, just like the other chromosomes within the cell, the overall function of that particular cell. And so understanding how chromosomal sex informs the biology of kidney cells or of eye cells or of muscle cells is really important. In addition, there are anatomical differences between males and females, so heart size might differ, and that's relevant to cardiovascular disease. And then the environment, the microbiome. We now know from a variety of studies that there is a sex to the gut microbiome that inhabits all of us.
So I would think, therefore, if I want to be a doctor or medical researcher or running the FDA or anywhere up and down the ladder, I would like to think that for the past 100, if not for the past 1,000 years, I've been very careful to consider any treatment and how different people would accept it differently based on their biology.
Right. And I think that's the surprise to everyone, that in fact, sex has not been a fundamental part of the way we look at biological systems. And, you know, at some level, this is just the way biology has always been done. And then science keeps building on what was done in the past. And I think that's the really critical question. Are there real adverse events that occur when you only use one sex? And the answer is, of course, yes. So something like 8 out of the last 10 drugs pulled from market by the FDA were because of this profound sex difference.
In the case of Ambien, the FDA was getting complaints for years from users who were sleepwalking, even sleep driving.
It's just heartbreaking to know that so many women had to wake up in the morning, and they still got up, but they went out and drove into the side of a mailbox because we didn't have sex as one of the variables that we would study.
8 hours after taking an Ambien, 10 to 15% of women still had enough Zolpidem in their system to impair daily function, compared to 3% of men. The FDA's ultimate recommendation? Women should take a smaller dose than men. The federal government had acknowledged for years the problem of excluding women from medical trials. In 1993, Congress required that women be included in all late-stage clinical trials funded by the National Institutes of Health, unless it was a drug taken only by men. But what that didn't do
was include males and females in the animal studies and the cell studies that are the precursor to all, that's the engine to all of medicine.
Meaning drugs that might be useful for women, but not for men, might not even get to the earliest stages of testing.
It wasn't that they were thinking, well, let's make it hard on women to have this drug down the line. I think they were thinking of trying to do the most clean study they could imagine. And the study group that they imagined were the simplest were the males.
Males were considered simple because they don't have menstrual cycles that change hormone levels. They don't get pregnant. They don't go through menopause. As one researcher puts it, studying only men, quote, reduces variability and makes it easier to detect the effect that you're studying. But ultimately, the exclusion of women was deemed inappropriate. In 2014, the NIH spent $10 million to include more women in studies. And in 2016, they decreed that all studies had to include sex as part of the equation.
And that date, January 25th, 2016, to me, there's a before and there's an after. And before that time, sex wasn't a variable in the way time or temperature or dose has always been. And I think we're going to see an enormous number of new discoveries simply because science now has an entirely new toolbox to work with.
So that's progress. But drug companies still like to use very narrow populations for their drug trials, the better to prove efficacy, of course. So exclusion still exists. On the other hand, it wasn't so long ago that exclusion from a certain kind of medical trial would have been a blessing.
The use of vulnerable populations of African Americans, people in prison, children in orphanages, vulnerable populations like these have been used for medical experimentation a fairly long time.
That is Evelyn Hammonds, a professor of the history of science and African American studies at Harvard. And this is Keith Wailu, an historian at Princeton.
You see it in the era when the birth control pill is being tested in Puerto Rico in the 1950s. And you see it in things like the Tuskegee syphilis study, which extended from the 30s into the 1970s.
The Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, as it was called, is one of the most infamous cases in U.S. medical history. Its goal was
trying to understand the long-term effects of venereal disease as it developed through its various stages. And the study was being conducted on a group of really poor African-American men.
White government doctors working for the U.S. Public Health Service found approximately 400 African-American men presumed to all have syphilis.
The problems emerge after penicillin is discovered and more widely used. And the question that should have been asked is, now that we have a series of effective treatments for venereal disease, ought we to continue a study of untreated syphilis or ought we to provide treatment?
So even though a syphilis treatment became available, it was withheld from the men in the study. Put aside for a moment the short-term elements of this maneuver, the cruelty, the ethical failure, consider the long-term implications. What happens when one segment of the population is so willfully exploited by the mainstream medical establishment? Well, that part of the population might develop a deep mistrust of said establishment. A recent study by two economists found that the Tuskegee revelation seriously diminished African Americans' participation in the healthcare system. They were simply less willing to go to a doctor or a hospital. The result? A decrease in male African-American life expectancy of about 1.4 years, which at the time accounted for roughly one-third of the life expectancy gap between blacks and whites. Next week on Freakonomics Radio, with such a fraught history of inclusion and exclusion in medical studies, who does end up in clinical trials?
When you look at the evidence, what you often find is that trials are conducted in absolutely perfect dream patients.
Also, How good are the new drugs that typically make it to market?
I think if we're honest with ourselves, we'll have to admit that the majority of new cancer drugs offer sort of very small gains at tremendous prices.
And what happens if you write about conflicts of interest among oncology researchers and then you go to an oncology conference?
I always wear a bulletproof vest.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or on iTunes, where you can also subscribe.